You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Today I have Amy Kaufman. She is an international best-selling author, acclaimed for her witty YA fantasies and sci-fi, and is published in over 35 countries. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
You are very welcome. So we're talking about Ladies' Night today, which is a bold, joyous twist on medieval legend, a sapphic fantasy full of witty banter, and a fourth wall-breaking narrator. Ladies' Night is also co-written with Megan Spooner. So my first question to you, Amy, is how on earth do you write with someone else?
Well, I mean, we add what you might call an extra layer of difficulty because we write from two different countries as well. Meg is in America. And, you know, on one hand, not being able to get together is quite tricky. But on the other hand, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of waking up and discovering that somebody has written a brand new chapter of your book for you while you slept, but I highly recommend it. I think the reason that we do it so well together is that we're also best mates. So we were flatmates for years. We know each other inside out. We always say that, you know, if you can handle very differing attitudes to doing the dishes, then you can handle any issues that might come up during writing a book. So we brainstorm together, we pass notes back and forth, and we take it in turns to write chapters.
Okay. So it must keep you on your toes then, as you say, if you wake up to like a character is veering in a different direction, that must be, is it unnerving or is it like exciting? It must be.
Look, on the odd occasion, and Meg would be laughing if she could hear me because she's the one who is, I'm more likely to wake up and find that Meg says, I know we said we were going to do X, but I've had an inspired idea about Y. But on the whole, we sort of know where we're going. You know, last year, on the back of one of my book tours for a different book, I was in the States, so we got a beautiful little cabin in California among the redwoods, and we stuck post-it notes all over the walls for a week and sort of figured out the outline. So we've got an idea, mostly, of where we're going.
Okay, so in that case, it forces you to be planners in a way.
It does, which is absolutely my natural habitat and not even a little bit poor Meg's natural habitat.
Oh,
but,
man.
You know, we meet in the middle. It means that she does do some planning because, you know, you can't have the other person waking up and saying, oh, that character's dead now. Ooh, okay. But, you know, I want to leave room for her process, which is that she will have these ideas and these sort of changes of direction as we're writing, and often they're inspired. So, you know, it's meeting in the middle.
Yeah, that's right. And that's, you know, it's a creative flowing, you know, it's a evolving book,
yeah,
isn't it? It's alive.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So it needs to be able to stay that way, I guess. So let's just talk a little bit about the actual story, which is, it's sort of a fairy tale, but it's a modern, playful, anachronistic fairy tale. So there are anachronisms like cheesecake on a stick and cheerleaders in there. It's a blacksmith's daughter meets Queen Bee, essentially.
Yes, it is. It's, you know, I mean, you know where this came from is during lockdown, the two of us were watching A Knight's Tale, the movie, together.
Okay.
We, you know, remember when we all used to do Netflix party and you'd all hit play at the same time and then you could chit chat as it went on? And we were watching A Knight's Tale. And because we love the anachronisms and we love the, you know, we will rock you while they're jousting and all of the jokes. And we got to the end of it. And it was 20 years old just as we were watching it. And we thought, on one hand, gosh, we still love this movie. On the other hand, there were a few things about it that we did not notice when we watched it 20 years earlier. And we thought to ourselves, what if the women in this movie had agency or, in some cases, names? And we started thinking about, I mean, Kate the blacksmith, you find out her name in the credits. So we started thinking about how we might tell that. How would you tell that story with women in it?
Beautiful.
What would change?
Okay, so that's wow, what a great beginning for our character Gwen, who is a blacksmith's daughter who secretly yearns to be a knight and enters the men-only tournament of dragon slayers disguised as a man. And then we have Lady Isabel, who is a noble woman, and she's being offered as a prize to the tournament winner, but she'd rather avoid an arranged marriage. So what happens next in our story?
Yes, Isabel is, look, she's a political player. She knows what she's doing most of the time, but she took her eye off the ball and found herself and her dowry put up as the prize for this tournament to be given away to whichever crusty old man wins it.
Great.
And she decides that she is a damsel who is going to rescue herself. So she spots Gwen and she works out what's going on. And Gwen's dream was only really just to ride the one round of the tournament. Gwen understands she lives in a world with limitations and she dreams of being a knight and she's made her own armour, but she's not silly. She knows what she can and she can't do. So her dream is that she is going to just ride the first round and then slip away in anonymity and no one will ever know it was her or that she was a girl. And that way she'll have proved to herself that her dream really was possible, even if it's not really practical. And once Isabel works out who she is and what's going on, Isabel comes and drags her out to ladies' night at the local pub and talks her into going the whole way. And the idea is, well, Gwen, if you win, you'll get this big fat stack of cash, which will help you a lot. I won't have to get married. Everyone's a winner. And then some unexpected feelings arise along the way as they pull off this this scheme.
Yeah, and you've sort of got this beautiful contrast of character. So Gwen is outwardly strong but emotionally hidden, would you say? And,
I would.
And Isabel is sort of self-assured yet feels trapped.
Yeah, Isabel was really interesting to write in that respect because, you know, she is a girl's girl. She loves pink. She loves a cocktail. She loves fashion. You know, her rooms look like a chocolate box exploded inside them. And I think it would be very easy for people to read, you know, to a character like that as you write them to become catty or to become shallow. And we were instead thinking about feminist icons like Elle Woods from Legally Blonde, who has so much more depth than you realise when you first meet her. And one of the sort of North Stars we had when we were writing Isabel was characters like Elle who always find something positive in what's going on, and no matter what they're presented with, always find a way to say, yes, but isn't that bit charming? Or, but don't you think he could be nice if only, you know, things were different? And so she's the queen bee of the castle, but one of the things that we really had in mind as we wrote this book was no mean girls.
Great.
The women in this book, they might occasionally be in competition and they might occasionally not like each other, but they don't mean girl each other. And for us, that was a really important line to draw.
Yeah, yeah, that's really progressive. It's kind of really reshaping the narrative in terms of how we, you know, think towards other women, how we behave towards our friends, our female friends.
Well, and how people expect young women to behave. So we really wanted to challenge that because our experience, you know, we both write young adult fiction. Between us, we've got 20-something, nearly 30 YA books that we've written, and our experience of our audience is that actually they lift each other up and actually they support each other and they're divine, and that this stereotype we find in the media is really unfair. So we wanted to reflect what we see in YA readers.
Okay, that's super positive. So let's go down that path of the female sort of driven fantasy or story. So this is a queer, women-centred fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
How does it change the genre when women are sort of leading this, you know, sort of extracting the men?
What a great question. I'm not asked this nearly enough because we thought about it a lot. We thought about what happens, what changes when it's two women and you come out of the normal dynamic that you see when a damsel's being rescued. And we thought about things like consent-seeking, about not I'm going to come in and rescue you and then ask later whether that was actually what you were after, but instead, do you want to be helped? Do you want to be rescued? What would that look like? And we wanted to see these girls collaborating and planning and, you know, as you were sort of hinting at earlier, they have very different personalities. But instead of that sort of creating clashes or competition, instead they honour what's different in each other. They enjoy what's different about each other. And it makes for a very different vibe. I think we didn't realise we had written what's often called a cozy fantasy because as far as we were concerned, we were like, well, she's under threat of forced marriage. And, you know, I mean, it's not a spoiler to say because it's on the back of the book. You know, there's dragons to be fought. There's a lot of drama in this. But what we have been hearing from readers more than anything, which makes me so happy, is that the book feels like a safe, soft place to land. It feels like somewhere you can come and not hit those sharp edges that the world so often aims at women.
Yeah, it definitely has a cozy feel, as you say. I think that's very, very apparent. And the humour is really there, and that sort of, you know, it's bolstered by this wonderful humour. Yeah. But I wonder if we have just a little bit of time to talk about this sort of quite sort of comical narrator that you have.
Yes.
Which is really adorable, and it really sets the tone for the book, I think.
We had so much fun with the narrator, and we really thought that the narrator was sort of going to be more entertaining to us than everyone else, and the narrator has turned out to be everyone's favourite part. The narrator breaks the fourth wall and addresses the audience directly and will say things like, now it's this part of the story, so we all know this is going to happen. Is that what you think is going to happen? And at one point the narrator says, things are going so well, but there's over 100 pages left, so you know it's not going to end that way. Would you like to put the book down now? And, yeah, the narrator points out the ridiculous and sort of invites us along for the ride, and, gosh, we had so much fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, I think we have just about enough time to have a little bit. Would you mind just giving us a little sample, sample of that narrator?
Get my reading
voice
on.
Thing, but yes,
all please. Right. So the narrator sounds quite different to the rest of the book because of the direct address, but I think let's start with the very opening.
Okay.
Imagine a castle. You've probably done this before, but in case you need a bit more guidance, imagine there are towers and spires and jagged crenellations made of grey stone. Colourful pennants fly from the rooftops, bearing a vicious-looking bronze dragon against a scarlet backdrop. There's a drawbridge on thick iron chains and a moat, because so long as we're imagining a castle, we might as well imagine a cool one with a moat. Maybe there are even crocodiles in the moat. No one told you this had to be realistic, after all. If you want crocodiles, you can have them. The castle sits on a slight hill overlooking several acres of fields, kept clear to make sure no one can creep up on anyone inside the castle walls. At the base of the gently sloping grassy rise is a reasonably sized town, set out in a ring full of all the sorts of shops you might expect. Places to buy and sell equipment, an alchemist's shop underneath a subtle sign bearing the mark of a hedge witch selling love potions. There's a tavern where all the heroes go to drink mead and recount their adventures, which sports a big sign proclaiming, "On Thor's days, we have a ladies' night." The streets are packed earth and the buildings are roofed with thatch, and it all looks a bit nerve-wrackingly flammable. This, by the way, is what people refer to as foreshadowing. But more on that later.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Amy Kaufman, for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. So your book is called Ladies Night.
Night with a K.
Yeah, with a K. It's also written by Megan Spooner too, and it's published by Allen & Unwin.
It is. You can get it now wherever good books are sold.
Thanks again.
And here is my interview with Madeline Watts, and we are on a road trip, if I can get this to work. It's not wanting to. Oh, there we go. Elegy Southwest by Madeline Watts is a road journey, a counterpointing of life and death, and an exploration of negative capability. So, Madeline, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you for having me.
I'm almost at a loss to know where to begin here. Eloise, our narrator, and her husband, Lewis, are driving back, having attended the funeral of Lewis's mother.
It's 10 months after Eloise's mother has died, and they are driving along the course of the Colorado River. So they're starting in Las Vegas, and they're going to end in Las Vegas, but I don't actually show you the ending in Las Vegas.
But then this notion of a road trip, the interstate as analog for social psychosis, for paranoia and fear, highways as a means of escape. It's a very conventional trope, this road journey.
Yeah. I was super interested in it, and always have been. I grew up between Sydney and Melbourne, and I was always travelling. So I was often on planes, but I was also often on very, very long car journeys between the cities. And so that idea of what happens in a road trip, particularly what happens to the two people in the car and the way that it becomes a sort of concentrated emotional space, was always so interesting to me. And then when I moved to America in 2013, you're so influenced and seeped in ideas of Americana and everything that you've sort of grown up with that comes through pop culture. And I realized that all of the road trip stories that I found really resonant were nearly always written or produced by outsiders. So like Lolita by Nabokov is such a beautiful road trip novel. And nobody thinks about it really like that, but half of it is a road trip. And I loved like Wim Wenders movies like Paris, Texas and things like that. And they're all made by people who were not from America. And that was something that felt like it allowed me maybe a little bit of leeway to start making my own kind of American road trip story and to think about it as this place where you can produce this really interesting emotional dynamic. You're moving from place to place the whole time. It has a kind of inbuilt structure to it, but it also creates this sort of emotional space that I found really interesting to work with.
But now we get the triviality of the road trip, things like let's pick up pizza. But at the same time, we've got this juxtaposition of life and death, the recollection of the death juxtaposed with Eloise thinking she or suspecting she could be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So this counterpointing of life and death.
Yeah, I was really interested in having both of those elements in the book and balanced, not necessarily having like a cause and effect relationship, but having all of those elements side by side. And it's not just the birth and death or life and death, but also even things like the sort of personal story that's being told and then the more ecological story that's being told, and both of those things getting to sit beside one another and be of equal value and equal weight, but not having necessarily to always have like one thing causing the other.
Well, let's get on to that ecological journey that you mentioned, because there's a bit of research going on into water and its use. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, life and death, again, you've had life brought to California, life brought to Las Vegas because of the marvelous engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But these cities now have grown beyond their capacity to survive.
Yeah.
So that life and death juxtaposition is in the landscape.
Yeah. And that fascinated me about that part of America. And I think that was so specifically bred in me by growing up in Australia during drought conditions and being so aware of like what you're meant to be doing when you don't have a lot of water. And being in Phoenix in the middle of the day, knowing that there was a drought and seeing sprinklers on like cement, like washing away cement at noon. And there's like a part of me that just wants to scream and make it stop. And I think there's something so hubristic and so incredibly American in a way that's both kind of horrific but also really wonderful and idealistic and utopian that I found so connected to the way that they treat water in that part of America.
But this now brings us on to the notion of negative capability. So it's that capacity to admire this beauty, even knowing there's a contradiction
mm-hmm.
there. And that's extraordinary. And therefore, you've got the personal in the road trip, you've got the environmental, and this notion of the melancholy mm-hmm. of the negative capability. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the negative capability for us, please?
It comes from Keats. I don't know that I can do the best job in the world of it now. I'm about a year out from finishing writing the book. But negative capability was Keats's idea, basically, that the writer or the artist looks into the abyss, basically, into the nothingness, and shouldn't be afraid of it and shouldn't avoid it, because out of the nothingness, out of that sort of vast pit of what existence might be, you might be able to recoup something, and there from there you can create things, and that's where true creativity can come from.
And also these notions of beauty, the ideals of beauty, even though it leads to a sense of contradiction. How mm-hmm. can this beauty exist? And that contradiction, which could be expressed in a variety of ways. So, for example, you've got an artist called Lawrence Greco, and this is where Lewis comes in, because he's mm-hmm. in a foundation sponsoring these things. But Greco has done this marvellous installation. But what happens to it? What is it and what happens to it?
So this is a piece of land art that I basically invented because I got very, very interested in land art, which is all, most of the big pieces are in that part of America. And it is an enormous hole, basically, in the desert that he has built, a completely sort of spherical absence in the desert that has been, they've been working on it for about 30 years. And there are sort of ways that mirrors will be installed and there'll be a connection to celestial time, and people have been really waiting out on it for a very long time. And what you end up finding out is that Lawrence Greco has died and his partner has been tasked with finishing off the piece. But according to Greco's will, has actually destroyed the sphere and has been working on restoring the desert to whatever, the closest thing you can get to its original state. And so nobody will ever actually see this perfect sphere in the ground. You will only ever know that it once occurred.
But also then nature will have its revenge, so to speak, anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can destroy, you know, a flood or a fire. Mm-hmm. Anything can come through. And such a magnificent concept can be undone so readily.
Yeah, which I think is so resonant with like the way that we're experiencing climate change. A lot of the times, these, you know, you try to change the course of a river, you try to control it, you try to manage it in all of these ways, but the river wants to be what the river wants to be.
Now, there's also other threads going through this. I call it a resonance of emotion, and these are just one or two things that struck me. How a woman from whom he was purchasing a tea cake had said, voila, just as his mother always had said, voila. Mm-hmm. And it brings back that memory of his mother's death. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing in something ordinary and something not necessarily associated, like a tea cake, mm-hmm. but it brings back a memory. And so you've got this happening all the way through the novel.
Yeah, I wanted it to be, I was very interested in the way that memory works. So that thing about the tea cake is from Roland Barthes talking about the way that grief worked with his mother. And she finds the parallel between the way that Lewis is experiencing his mother's grief to be basically the same thing, that something will everything will be kind of working fine, and then something will happen, and suddenly it will be the grief will be as fresh as if it had happened last week, which I think is often true to the way we experience grief. There's this idea that you're meant to like work through the stages and then you'll be finished. And I think mostly grief happens to you, it completely changes you, and you rebuild your life around the grief. And I don't think that those stages, that sort of like linear idea really is accurate to the experience of it. And I think that memory is so tied to grief, and the way that it doesn't work in a linear way, and the way that we sort of start to experience our own interior time can be so connected. You can feel that things in the past are so much more immediate necessarily than the things that are happening to you maybe right now in the present.
But it makes up the landscape of our lives in many ways. So, yeah. You know, this connection with landscape, this connection with negative capability. Mm-hmm. And so it would be the same for love as mm-hmm. well, remembering an affection through something you see years later. Mm-hmm. And so it's all part of that whole fabric, which is astonishing.
And that's why, so the book is sort of happening in November 2018, but it's very much told about 5 years in after that. So it's told in around 2023, because I wanted her to be constantly, to have this sort of process of remembering, and that the remembering is so much part of the book. And the longer the book goes on, the less it becomes completely tied to the chronology of the road trip. And she starts to jump into the past and jump into the future.
So, yes, that narrative style, you've got her looking back on the past, but by the end of the novel, we're projecting into the future, even though we're still on the road trip. Mm-hmm. So it adds then to that notion of the interconnectedness of time, of things, of belief, of being, of all those other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got other marvellous things like Eloise getting a mother-in-law's Fitbit. Mother-in-law's passed away. And it's like, it's not an inheritance, it's almost a continuation of somebody else's life.
Yeah, you can, in the data, their data becomes the same data. So the heartbeat, like, you know, it's just picked up on somebody else's heartbeat. It occurred to me that could be, you could just put it on anybody and it could continue on. And there is a, I was interested in having that sort of that connection to death through the physical body.
Let's get on to Chekhov's gun. This concept in short stories that if something is mentioned, mm-hmm. it therefore has a purpose or can be used in the story. Mm-hmm. You mention everything.
Yeah, although there is a gun, there is deliberately a gun, and nothing happens to the gun. The gun isn't used. So I played around a little bit with that. They find a gun in one of the houses that they stay in on the road trip, and the gun doesn't get used. But everything else is a bit of a Chekhov's gun. So that was me having a bit of a joke.
But it all does interconnect. And we've been rather vague because we don't want to give anything away. I mean, as we said, Eloise suspects she's pregnant. What happens there? The relationship and the intensity that you talk about between Eloise and Lewis, what happens there? Mm-hmm. How do we handle grief and what happens there mm-hmm. and the consequences of it? So, unfortunately, Madeline, we're going to have to end the interview there because we are running out of time. And given the complexity of the novel, I don't know if I've actually done it justice. But the book is Elegy Southwest. It's about relationships, of the continuation of emotion across time, and how much of this is exemplified in the landscape and in this notion of negative capability, a poetic concept. And it's from Ultimo Press. So, Madeline, thank you very much for coming and talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.